Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Movie Addict Headquarters with your host, Betty Jo Tucker, author of Confessions of a Movie Addict, right here at www.blogtalkradio.com.
Toto, I've a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. That's right, Dorothy. This is Movie Addict Headquarters. You don't have to be a movie addict to visit here, but if you are one, it's definitely the place for you. I'm your host, Betty Jo Tucker, and today we'll be talking about deep cinema with Mary Trainor Brigham, whose new book about that subject has changed the way I look at movies. But first, I want to mention how proud I am of my excellent producer, Nikki Starr, who recently received a promotion here at Blog Talk Radio. Congratulations, Nikki.
Thank you very much.
Well, you certainly deserve it. Can you tell us a little bit about what your new responsibilities will be?
Well, I'll be producing the new Woman's Day show every Monday at noon from noon to 12:30, and then working in business solutions and putting together projects for new hosts and VIP production.
You're going to be busier than ever, right?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Well, we're just so lucky to have you here with us, and I just can't thank you enough for all the help that you give us and that you're handling the chat room, because you know I'm technologically challenged and can't seem to talk and type and chat at the same time. And also, please feel free to chime in whenever you want to. And I know we have a lot of fun on our show. And
yes.
Nikki, I've always told you that I like movies primarily because of their escapist entertainment value. But today, we're taking a more serious look at them. And let me tell you why I'm so excited about our special guest today. A couple of weeks ago, I watched Disaster Movie and The House Bunny, both during the same week. And believe me, I was in a deep funk. And the only way I got out of it, I was in that funk because, I mean, I just had to think about the future of films, because those films were so bad. But I got out of the funk by reading a wonderful book called Deep Cinema, Film as Shamanic Initiation. And I said to myself, we have to get the author of this book on our show. Mary Trainor Brigham has the most fascinating background. Just listen to this. She's an art therapist with a master's in culture and spirituality, and she's also a film critic. And I'm so jealous about this. Her column was submitted for a Pulitzer Prize for distinguished criticism, and she's noted for combining her passions for cinema and indigenous cultures in therapeutic programs and international workshops and documentary films. She also consults on scripts and during film production, and she offers teleseminars. And in this book, Deep Cinema, she brings together her passions for cinema and indigenous cultures, while she makes a compelling case for deeper cinematic storytelling. And let me tell you, Disaster Movie and The House Bunny, neither one of them were deeper cinematic stories. So it's my great pleasure now to welcome Mary Trainor Brigham to our show. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Betty Jo. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm just so happy you could be here. Why don't you start out by telling us what motivated you to write Deep Cinema?
Well, you know, when you ask me that, I can feel
two motivations, you know, welling up in me. One was positive and one was negative.
Oh.
And actually, that's really a good way to even introduce Indigenous thought, because from the Celts to the Kahuna, from Siberia to Australia, Native peoples always teach us that life comes from an alternating current of positive and negative.
Right.
And that we should just be standing in the middle of all the positive and negative currents that we endure, and not clinging to one or avoiding the other, but letting them polish us. And so the positive motivation was my increasing fascination for the sophistication and beauty of Indigenous wisdom around the world. All my life I've been attracted to it. You know, like as a child, you know, I'd want to be the Indian instead of the cowboy, you know. But it's certainly, and even as a raised as a young Irish Catholic girl in school, we'd be raising money for pagan babies and the missionaries. And I think that the Indigenous people they were going to convert had a better lifestyle, even then. So it must be something in me from a past life. I don't know. But as I grew older, the teachings from Indigenous cultures really served me more than this culture. So that brings us to the negative motivation, which is my increasing alarm at how hollow modern Western culture has become, and thus our storytelling is reflecting that.
Wow, you were raised as a Catholic, and your background, your ethnic background, is Irish American.
Yes.
So I think that Nikki Starr and I can identify with the Irish American background, can't we, Nikki? Nikki must be busy in the chat.
I know, oh, okay.
That's my background exactly, yes, and thank you. I was muted and chatting.
Yes, so we were the same as you, Mary, always donating money, you know, to go to the third world or the poorer sections of society, and that does explain a lot. And I'm so glad that you took the time to write this book. I really enjoyed the sections where you explained why certain movies are examples of deep cinematic storytelling. And I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about a couple of them. And the first one that I was so pleased to see you mention in your book is Whale Rider.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And I think that hits on so many facets of what I'm trying to endorse in my book. And you know, clearly one thing would be I would be anxious to see more movies about Indigenous cultures, and that one is so purely that. I mean, you know, you'll have a movie like Once Were Warriors, and that would show the Indigenous culture up against the European culture and how the European culture has been destructive of it. But Whale Rider is so much more pure in that the impulse to preserve the culture came from within the culture itself, and so to my sights, that fact that it shows the restoration of tribal ceremony and ritual and customs, you know, is wonderful, because we're so encouraged to resign ourselves to this idea of the vanishing tribes, you know, that it's inevitable that they're going to be all assimilated into the modern world.
Yes.
And I know that there's a great deal of resistance to that going on, and I also know that there's a great deal of movement to restore sovereignty of Indigenous properties and lands, and in Hawaii itself, the descendants of the queen who was overthrown are still alive, and they see that as their own nation, and they want restoration of their sovereignty. So it's not like everyone's been, you know, plowed under and reemerged as European variations. You know, it hasn't happened. Colonialization has taken a darker turn, I think, in that we're all subjected now to kind of a corporate colonialization and the mutant marketplace, what I call. But in Whale Rider, we're spared all that. We're set in a beautiful setting. We're allowed. It restores. It heals what I call a hole in our ethnosphere. You know, Wade Davis is a botanist and also an anthropologist who came up with that term, ethnosphere, the idea that we have a whole envelope of wisdom and knowing that comes about from the variations of different peoples on Earth, and that we've been eroding that, you know, by taking away the languages and destroying these cultures. But here we show an adolescent girl, which is, again, if we go back to Irish roots and you look at the Celtic medicine wheel, in the East you have a young maiden who walks through a field, and every place she walks, flowers bloom. And so a young girl, you know, in Rail Rider, being the one that is so full of her sense of personal destiny that she actually claims, you know, her right to try to become the chief.
Yes, and wasn't Keisha Castle Hughes fabulous in that role?
Did you see her interview on the bonus features?
No, I didn't. I saw it at a film festival before it was actually released.
I was just
absolutely bowled over by that film and by her performance, and was so pleased when she got nominated for an Oscar.
I was rooting for her that night so strongly.
The intensity of her and her just stick to it. She's going to, no matter what obstacles, she's going to meet her destiny.
And yes, and overcoming the grief of her grandfather's disapproval, you know, that was so strong, you know, it was fabulous. And you should check out the extras, the bonus material, because she's adorable in that. I mean, she must have been like, you know, what, 10 or 11 when they discovered her to play the role? I mean, and, you know, she says in the interview that she'd all her life she wanted to be an actor, and she'd almost given up when they discovered her.
Darling
is that?
She was just terrific. That was, of course, a once in a lifetime role. And then the relationship that she had with her grandmother really hit home with me.
Yeah,
because my
grandmothers
were
mentoring.
So important to me. And the casting in that, just, and then all of the cultural activities that we got to see.
When the grandmother was chanting, you know, that was so powerful. You know, she was lovely. And the fact that she stuck to the girl and she showed her loyalty to the girl time and time again. You know, whenever the grandfather put up a stop sign, the grandmother turned it into a detour sign.
That's a great way to put it.
It was.
And what do you think is the most important characteristic of Whale Rider and being classified as deep cinema?
Well, there's more than one. The idea of mentoring, that the uncle and the grandmother mentored her into her chiefdom. The idea of an indigenous culture getting restored, this actual tribe, you know, bringing back its customs and ritual and ceremony in the modern age. You know, not setting this in the past. And also the sense of animals as ancestral and totemic and part of their extended family, and the beautiful music, you know, with the whale song, you know, so gorgeous. So I there's so many facets to this that I think are important. But I guess I'd have to say the central one is restoring indigenous culture in the modern age. Yeah,
absolutely. I agree with you there. And for our listeners who haven't seen Whale Rider, please, please, please thank heavens for DVDs, because I'm sure it is available. And Mary, you persuaded me to check it out on DVD and to look at those bonus features. But that's it's just a film that you'll never forget once you watch it. It'll be with you.
And did you know that the young actress there didn't know how to swim?
And she was supposed to be riding that whale.
I know, into the depths, a thousand fathoms deep. And she told the woman who was, you know, casting, you know, the lead, when they asked her, could you swim, and she said she could. She was so determined to grab the part. So she had spirit and spunk even there.
Well, a lot of that spunk came through in her performance. And, you know, Mary, I was surprised at first to see that you had such a positive reaction to Dead Man. And that's one of the few Johnny Depp films that I didn't enjoy. Well, actually, there are three of his films that I haven't enjoyed, and Dead Man is one of them. Ed Wood, I know most people really like that. And then The Libertine. And I thought he did a great job in Dead Man, but I thought it was just a film that was too old fashioned, and it was in black and white, and I guess I wasn't used to that. But after reading your review, I'm just ashamed of my review. Because I didn't see all of these things that were going on in the film that you point out in your book. So go ahead and talk a little bit about Dead Man. What makes this movie so special to you?
I just wanted to interject that if you look at the libertine from the psychological perspective of a young man who was either psychologically or maybe physically incested by his mother, you'll get a better take on it. I have to say, as a therapist, I think the mother exploited him, you know, and controlled his life so much. Why else would he start out with that incredible monologue saying, you know, he was a man of seduction and revulsion? If he hadn't
been
violated.
That was the best part of the movie, the monologue, I thought. And
The whole film was too physically dark. It was too physically dark on top of a dark subject matter to really catch fire, you know?
Right, and the physical changes that he had to undergo in that film really, really disturbed me. But he did a wonderful job, as he always does. But getting back to Dead Man, what was so special to you, and what makes this film a good example of deep cinema?
Would it be all right if I just read the first paragraph from my book on that?
Oh, please, please do. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I call it Shadow Culture, Dead Man. Director Jim Jarmusch wonderfully manages to turn the iconic Western on its head, showing the Euro-Americans' continental expansion for the indigenous tragedy that it was, without ever once sounding a preachy note. With elements quirky, droll, mystical, gruesome, and at times downright deranged, this elegantly black-and-white buddy-on-horseback movie manages to give weight to the native man's perspective merely by making the white man's so light. And that starts with
L-I-T-E.
Yes, and that starts with the sheer physicality of the two key players, Johnny Depp as William Blake and Gary Farmer as Nobody.
And Nobody was the Native American, and he was kind of a 1800s Dr. Kevorkian. He was helping Johnny Depp's character go on his ultimate journey. Pick up right on that?
Yes, and I think as far as he was concerned, you know, he saw him as a dead man from the get-go. You know, and that I think is a huge piece of deep cinema is appreciating how indigenous cultures make the spirit in matter the alpha and omega of all life. That spirit is the most essential thing that we all exist from, you know? And they see it in matter, and they see it in humans, and they see it in animals. It's not limited to the top of a human being or to a masculine god in the sky. It suffuses everything. And so whether Johnny Depp's character was dead when he met him or was dying, you know, it wouldn't matter to him. He saw through to his spirit from the very beginning.
And Johnny Depp played this accountant that came west for a job in a little western town called Machine,
mm-hmm.
and then got in all sorts of trouble. He didn't get the job, and he ended up killing somebody that he shouldn't kill, and then he goes on this journey that nobody takes him on. And it seemed to me that there so much time was spent on this walk to the river.
Yes.
That didn't bother you.
Oh, well, no, it was, you know, a long haul, but it, you know, it did show his development. He integrated his shadow, you know, and he was also representing the shadow of the Native Americans. The white person was shown to be the shadow. So it, to me, it was interweaving. Yet, yeah, I get what you're saying in terms of, that was a bit of a haul, but they leavened it with the comedy, and also just showing him, you know, taking on the role of William Blake and thinking that he was a poet and taking on, you know, his dark side by, you know, killing the men hired to kill him and everything. You know, he was going through a life's worth of development and integration in a short amount of time, and he had to. You know, he had to. He was just a young man. He was an orphan, which I thought was a good choice because the indigenous people give so much weight to their ancestry, and the, you know, Euro-Americans have lost their ancestry when they come here for the most part. And he comes across on that train. He's an orphan. And as you go across in the train, the iron horse, you know, there's no sense of magnificent manifest destiny. As the train advances, the people on the train become more and more depraved. You know,
right,
so
I remember that scene,
to the point where they're just shooting buffalo for sport out the window. you know, and there's prostitutes and gunslingers, and then contrast that with the beautiful native village at the very end.
Yes,
you know,
with
his women and children
that.
And artisans and just a whole different life. And the Europeans failed to see this, failed to see into the depths of the people here, because I think we've all suffered what the psychologist Chelis Glendinning calls cultural post-traumatic stress. I think back in Europe with the Inquisition, which went on for hundreds of years and included, you know, Shakespeare's time, that the native Europeans were uprooted from their peasant soil and from their sense of sacredness in the earth and in animals and in plants. You know, with so many people who came and conquered the Americas had lost, you know, their indigenous souls. And so they come over here and they can't recognize it in the people who have cultivated it for thousands of years. You know, so Johnny Depp's character couldn't see. He couldn't see. And yet there's a certain beauty in the end, the very end of it all, that, you know, regardless of how shallow unevolved we might be in life, we're all given this beautiful opportunity to return to the source, you know?
Well, it certainly was a different type of Western, as you said in your opening paragraph, and it grapples with the universal themes of facing one's death and meeting one's destiny, and it's another one of those films that stays with you and that you think about. But we're so used to Technicolor now, all sorts of color in the films, and so when a black and white film comes along, it kind of shocks our system. But
yes,
I can see why that particular type of photography was used in this.
There was a scene or two, Betty Jo, that would have been too gruesome in color. You know, I won't mention, but I'm sure you can review.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
right.
And I think that's another reason they chose it. And then the twangy music, Neil Young was so great. You know, I really enjoyed it. And I wouldn't have chosen it for my last, you know, movie in the book if I didn't enjoy it so much.
That's what I thought, and you spent a great deal of time with that film and explaining why you thought it was definitely deeper cinematic storytelling, and I appreciated that, because anytime Johnny Depp can get mentioned anywhere, I'm happy. Especially if it's a good review.
Yay.
Well, yay is right. You know, I was wondering also about the film where what is the title? I'm reaching for it here. What Dreams May Come,
mm-hmm.
The 1998 movie with Robin Williams. And that certainly fits into deeper storytelling. In fact, it was so deep, I had quite a bit of trouble understanding it, but I loved the way it looked. So,
oh, wasn't that amazing? Yeah.
It was just gorgeous, and of course it did win an Oscar for best visual effects, and I have no quarrel with that.
Mm.
But that certainly had a spiritual meaning, that particular film. And you did speak positively of it in your book. So what makes that particular film special to you too?
Well, while there's a number of movies that address past lives, you know, show people encountering one another, you know, in one epic and then recognizing that they've met each other from another time, or even movies with ghosts, there's plenty of movies with ghosts. This is the only mainstream one that I've seen that imagines life between lives. And if you study indigenous cultures, or even, you know, go back to the pre-Christian Irish culture, or Tibetan culture, Egyptian culture, any indigenous culture, they usually have mapped out these bardo states after we die, different states of consciousness. Even the Monroe Institute does it in a more technological manner. But showing that we go through it just the way a baby comes out of the womb, you know, and when it's been in the womb, we haven't been using our lungs, we haven't been using our eyes, and then we come to obviously a greater state of, you know, physical capability, you know, as we get on our own. And, you know, similarly, this is showing that there are increased powers that we possess as we advance into a more divine status. And it shows that, you know, we create our own heaven or hell, that, you know, the people who died rather innocently and suddenly in automobile accidents, you know, went on to heaven, and the wife and mother who despaired and chose suicide, you know, found her own hell. You know, and so it just shows that we actually have a say in where we're going, you know, and that there is a time of choice on the other side, and that we have some mapping out of what we're going to be returning to, and we have a say in that. In another movie that I have in the beginning of my book is a rare film called Between Heaven and Earth, and that in that film, an unborn baby communicates with its mother from within the womb, and I think that's an equally important film, you know, along with What Dreams May Come, in terms of looking at that period before we're born and after we die.
I haven't seen that particular movie, so I'll have to check it out. And
it's hard to find. It's not on Netflix or anything that I know of.
The name of it is
European. Between Heaven and Earth.
Between Heaven and Earth. And I'm reminded, as you're talking about those two movies, about one of my all-time favorite films called The Fountain, with Hugh Jackman and Rachel Weisz.
She's lovely. Yeah.
Those two characters represented. It's a very complicated movie, but I think they represented eternal love and the struggle between death and immortality. And here is a very deep film. It had mysticism, spirituality, and symbolism, and of course Hugh Jackman, Be Still My Heart. So that would be one that I would toss in. I know you didn't mention it in your book, but I think that would be probably my top number one deep cinema film.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. There are some movies, I mean, I'm working on the second book now, and there are some movies that didn't make it into the first one not because they were lacking, but because they had so many facets that actually served it, that they would have taken up too much time to do them justice, and that's the case in some of these movies. But
well,
I am working on the second one.
When will your next book come out?
I don't have a deadline on it. My publisher, Michael Weissy, has asked me to do a book that's kind of a companion piece that has, you know, reviews in it from a deep cinematic perspective. And my husband is an actor, and we're looking at going around the year and suggesting a series of movies that you watch, you know, from spring through winter, you know, that will go through that the round of the year and celebrate it.
I can't wait for that.
And we're looking at the Celtic. We're looking at Celtic teachings for that, you know, because
so many people have
that. In this book, I work with the Vodun and the Hawaiian. So I have Haitian and Hawaiian teachings to help people understand the shamanic templates. But in the second book, my husband suggested we do Celtic. So I think I'll recommend that to Michael Weissy, you know, when we get it outlined better.
Well, Nikki and I are going to second that motion, because we definitely would want to hear more about the Celtic contributions. And we'll be first in line to buy the book, right? I forgot to ask about another movie that you mentioned in your book. And I think there was only one kind of fleeting mention, but it's a movie that I really enjoyed and found very moving, but it had a lot of action in it too. And it's Blood Diamond, the Leonardo DiCaprio movie of a couple of years ago, and I think it does fit in somewhat into what you're talking about in this book, because of the clash of the two cultures.
Well, I love Blood Diamond, and it was the very first time I was blown away by Leonardo DiCaprio.
Same here.
And I thought he was just fabulous in that. And Jennifer Connelly, you know, she showed something in her role there that I want to see a lot more of, just like Rachel Weisz in The Constant Gardener, showing young women who are idealistic and who are activists and who have international concern and who are beautiful. And they know they're beautiful and they're fine with their beauty and they enjoy their beauty, but they don't make it the ultimate priority. And they push past that into their destiny, which is serving something relational, which is an ultimate feminine principle. And, you know, I was glad to find out when I was researching Blood Diamond that Jennifer Connelly actually has worked for UNICEF precisely on the issue of stopping the child soldiers over in Africa.
Oh,
so
good
I've
for
got
her.
To, yeah, I've got to congratulate her on that and thank her for that. But I love that movie. There's so, again, that's one of the ones that has so many facets to it that make it valuable for deep cinema. And I only, you know, reference it briefly as an example of modern children being imperiled. In using the two templates, the Hawaiian and the Haitian template for the shamanic view, worldview, I chose the Haitian one for a couple of reasons. It was a doorway to Africa and African spirituality. And also, Hollywood has actually just totally misrepresented voodoo and voodan, you know, spirituality, which is a fabulous spirituality, but you know the Marines.
They just make it horror movies. They just put it
always, yes, yeah, exploding heads and you name it, and walking, you know, the zombies. And the thing is, America occupied Haiti for a while. I think back in the 1940s, and every Marine that came home from that gig wrote some cheesy dime store novel about voodoo and didn't have any clue what they were talking about. And those began the movie industry. And there's many more political reasons why Haiti has been reduced to the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. And you can reference my book for some of that, I do think it's horrific. But I did love Blood Diamond, and because in Haiti, in the upper, lower, and middle world of Haitian shamanism, the upper world, of course, is the spirit realm. The lower world is the ancestral realm. In the middle world, according to them, middle world is always the world we live in, according to shamanic worldviews. It's the one we see and we operate in. But for the Haitians who practice voodoo, the middle world is divided between the marketplace and nature.
Yes, and I'm going to stop you for just 1 minute because I think we do have a caller who's been very patient holding on. And hold that thought, and let's check with area code 646. Hello, caller. Thank you for holding. Who's calling?
Hi, Betty Jo. It's Jane Bernard. How are you?
Jane Bernard, I'm so glad you called in. I was just telling Mary before the show that I think you and she are soul sisters, and I was telling her about your book, The Fine Tuning of the Senses, so you two should get along just fine. Do you have a question or comment for Mary?
I do. There are two movies that came to mind that I really love that I think are not necessarily related to the same primitive indigenous cultures that Mary mentioned, but are very real in terms of talking about how the spirit suffuses everything. And one of them is Braveheart, where the spirit is yearning for freedom. And the other one is The Fifth Element, which, even though it's completely fictitious, it takes essential elements of humanity and brings them into the future. And I was wondering what Mary's perspective is on those two movies.
Well, I enjoy, the elements of Braveheart that do just show the tribal and indigenous dimensions, the woad and I do think the warrior element can be, well utilized. And I'm not familiar with the other one, The Fifth Element. Can you say more about that?
Oh, I loved it. I haven't seen it for a very long time. It takes place in the future, and it's about a time in the world where there's many universes, but the essence is that the fifth element, the thing that's going to save humanity and bring everything together, is basically the heart.
Oh, yes. Well, that
was
fabulous.
Yes. Was this the Bruce Willis?
Yes.
Film, right, and it was another one that was very stunning in terms of the visual effects. A very, very good looking sci-fi film.
Every once in a while, Bruce Willis acts more like a Pisces, which he is. So much of the time he acts like an Aries, and so I'm curious about his chart. But he does occasionally do a real intriguing job with something more, spiritually oriented. I'm glad to see.
Well, I think everyone pretty much knows about Braveheart, so I don't think we have to encourage people to check that film out. But The Fifth Element may be one that they've missed. So I thank you, Jane, for calling our attention to that. It's been a while since I've seen it too, so I plan to check it to check it out. Was there any other comment or question that you had for Mary?
Not really. You know, there have been a lot of movies. There was a movie recently where I think it was called The Letter, where a woman moved into a house. I think it was Sandra Bullock. She moved into a house in the country, and she put a letter in the mailbox, and Keanu Reeves had lived there before, but he died. And he gets the letter, and they carry on this whole correspondence. It's between two different times of being alive, and you had talked earlier about that concept. Are you familiar with that movie?
Yes,
The Lake House.
The Lake House.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. That was, I hate to say this, but I am a critic, and so it's my job. I thought that was the most ridiculous romantic movie that I've ever seen. But I do like those two actors.
I wasn't thinking of it as a romantic movie. I was more thinking about, Mary had talked earlier about movies that that address the concept of, you know, a time between life.
Yes, it was
you
good.
You were talking
good...
about a movie earlier with, I can't remember, he's usually a comedian.
Oh, Robin Williams.
With Robin Williams that addressed that. So I was wondering if you think, you know, that cinema, because I know, I from what I understand, really you feel, and I agree with you, that it's really important for cinema to take a more conscious role about the messages that they're giving. And I was wondering if you think that possibly that many times they touch on these things in a light way to sort of bring people in to be more provocative. It's in the guise of a silly love story, as Betty Jo points out. But if you just think about the possibilities of life between lives, then it's actually very provocative.
Good point.
And I hope they do more movies along those lines, just so that we get a sense that our soul is, you know, our soul is part of the story of the earth. The Earth is part of the story of the solar system family. That's part of the, you know, galaxy. I mean, we go back until the very, very beginning. There are processes in our bodies that go back to the birth of the universe. We wouldn't be alive. There are processes that plants have discovered that sustain us and give us sight. There are, you know, the fact that we have a spine and two arms and legs and a head go back to the mammals and the reptiles, and you know, we participate in a huge story. We are universes walking on Earth, and if we just told stories that went deeper, that would begin to give our souls some solace, and would begin to excite us and give us more momentum to be much more powerful this life.
Oh, I like what you said there,
right,
Mary. Yeah, Jane.
And I think, you know, if I might comment on that, I think that what would happen is that people would become passionate about things and connect to that. And when people are really connected to a sense of passion about life or about purpose, then they feel like a kind of an inner thrust of momentum. Is that what you mean?
Yes, beautiful.
Well said. And Jane, would you stay on the line with us for a little while?
Sure, I'll be glad to.
Great. I wanted to check with Nikki to see how things are going in the chat. Nikki, are there any comments or questions from the chat that you'd like to share with us?
Well, actually, we got Jane to call in and talk about The Fifth Element and Braveheart, so she took care of that for us. And
right.
I think that, wasn't that great? Love Jane. And I think that, for me, there's been a little bit of discussion about what makes a movie deep. And I've taken out of it things like symbolism and, you know, being able to get lost in a type of movie that makes you think of something philosophical.
Mm.
And, yes, that is visually beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But can be left to interpretation by each person watching it. So
I think that element of mystery is very important.
Yeah.
That's so important, because sometimes people will take a topic like, you know, even mortality, and they'll tell it in such a predictable way that it just squeezes out all the mystery, and that just, again, we're deeper and deeper into ever more shallow water at that point. And so mystery, the multiple interpretations, the ability for everyone to engage in it and identify on some level is certainly vital.
I think that's a very good summary. And you're right, Nikki, or the people in the chat are right about the individual interpretations that people put to these films being important too. I wanted to ask Mary, what are your favorite all-time favorite movies?
Oh, okay. I just want to finish saying the thing I was saying, that in Haiti the marketplace is considered the human half, and then there's nature, and that they teach that we should behave in the marketplace with the same harmony and sustainability as nature. And I think one of the biggest warnings I have in the book is that the marketplace and the corporations have overtaken even our humanity. And that's what you see in Blood Diamond, that the indigenous people are being overrun and exiled and becoming forced to be refugees, so that some corporation in London and in Belgium, wherever, you know, can come in and steal their diamonds and falsely drive the price up on diamonds, you know, and people
and
are dying.
Cause of the warfare there.
Yes, and people are having their hands chopped off for diamonds, you know. And so,
I don't want any blood diamonds. I've told my husband, don't ever give me any blood diamonds, and all my family, no blood diamonds.
Well, and it gives us that responsibility to track, you know, where all our purchases come from, so that they're not at someone's cost, the cost of someone. How can you buy something that represents love, you know, an engagement ring, what it means, the destruction of someone's love in their family and their marriage and everything. It's just horrific. So I wanted to go back and say I love Blood Diamond. There's just so much to it. I just loved it. But my favorite movies, you know what? I realized when you asked that the movies, I'm sure there are some movies that I love that, you know, are actually more peaceful, but I tend to think of movies that surprise me. Those are the ones that stay on my, you know, organically evolving list of favorites. I'd hate to have to carve it in stone, but movies that I walked away from just with an aha factor, you know, and a deepening and awakening within myself would be movies like The Conformist. And I start my book with that because I went into Boston to see a movie that was predictable, Elvira Madigan, and ended up seeing The Conformist instead, and it just, you know, blew all my circuits. And I introduced the book with that experience to show that
I
film.
I know. What a beautiful way to introduce the book. I want to encourage all the listeners to buy your book and to read it very carefully. In fact, we have the cover on the site. The Movie Addict Headquarters site, so just click on the cover and that takes you right over to Amazon.com. But I cannot believe that we're out of time, Mary. It just went by so fast, and I want to thank you for being such an enlightening guest. It's really been an honor to have you on our show, and
thank you so much, Jane.
Thank you,
my
Jane,
pleasure.
For calling
thank you, Jane.
In.
A pleasure.
I
nice
know,
to meet you, Mary.
I know you're going to have a lot of success with this book, and I hope you'll come back because I know you're involved in a lot more projects that we would like to talk about. So, and I'm trying to get Jane back on the show too. So will both of you come back at another date?
Oh, thank you.
Sure, of course.
And thank Nikki
as
well, you know, for having me.
Mm. Great. This is Betty Jo Tucker giving a big shout out to the folks at Broad Talk Radio for all their help in connection with the show. Special thanks to Nikki Starr for everything she does to make sure our show happens, and to everyone who listened live or to the archives, and again to Jane for calling in or took part in the chat. We really appreciate your participation. Remember, dear listeners, don't let your life become worse than a horror movie by falling victim to identity theft, the fastest growing crime in America. Instead, go to lifelock.com, that's LIFELOCK.com, and sign up for the important services there. You'll receive a 10% discount if you use our special code, REALTALK, that's REELTALK, and it's all one word. Now to close the show, here's the talented AJ Daniels with a song Nikki and I dedicate to all our Blog Talk Radio listeners.
love you, then you'd be forced to love me too. If you knew how much I adore you, you'd stay with me and be true.